Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 21 of The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, the first of season 3. This one is all about the war in the heavens. Now that I've released 20 episodes of this nuggety gem of a podcast, 22 if you count previews, I think it's a good time to pause, reflect, and think about what I'm doing here in The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast. My intention at the very beginning was to explore this remarkable land of magic and mystery, treading through the many and varied paths of its history, culture, geography, and trade, reaching back over more than 2,000 years from the present day. A big job, some might say, but I see it as standing inside and opening the doors to a vast and wonderful outside. Then, heading out there in a spirit of inquiry and adventure. Thus far, we've done a lot of history and political exploration, mostly concentrating on the hugely important realm of Anarquist, one of the many on this vast continent that is the world below the war in the heavens. We've met devious and dastardly types, heroic and noble types, dissipated and dissolute types, and all sorts in between. We've covered plots, alliances, disasters, triumphs, and shenanigans that just won't quit. But something's been nagging at me, something important that I've left uncovered, unexplored, and almost shunned, and that's the war in the heavens itself. A podcast, for goodness sakes, called The World Below the War in the Heavens. And while I've been busy bringing you fantastic stories about the world below, I haven't delved into the other half of the title, the titular War in the Heavens. So here's where I redress this failing, with many apologies to all those out there who've been wanting to know more about this war in the heavens, this battle in the firmament, this conflict beyond the skies. As a start, as a real basic level, just imagine a world where the divine didn't have to be taken on faith. A place where hard evidence of celestial beings is regularly presented to the people. A world where proof of the extraordinary is available to all and sundry. And now, this would certainly affect the outlook of everyone in that world. Belief in the divine isn't required. The celestial is part and parcel of the world. This is the world below the war in the heavens. In the heavens above this world, a war has been going on since the dawn of time, a war between gods and demons. The results of this war regularly plummet to the world below. At times, some observers have claimed to have been able to see the actual battle underway, but these claims are controversial and have led to argument, conflict, and even to religious groups breaking away from the universal temple, resulting in religious wars, but more of that later. The earliest known heavenfall is lost in the mists of time, and to reach back that far in the history of the world below the war in the heavens means we have to understand the calendar system that's used there. The year zero, or the beginning of what some people call the true era of the world below the war in the heavens, was marked as such by a large heavenfall that occurred near the major population centre of the time, and, more importantly, one that had a literate culture, where there was a veritable swag of curious writers who competed against each other to document this heavenfall. As such, we have a number of records of this event, many of which have eyewitnesses, and most of these have survived up until the present day. A large spear fell to earth a few miles from what now known as Spear Point on the east coast of the continent, 100 miles or so east of the now lost kingdom of Yesen, which at the time was a substantial realm with considerable trading credentials. It was prosperous, which is important, for it's this sort of prosperity that enabled a class that was literate enough to have professional scribes, scholars, and an educated elite that was also interested in the idea of documenting the world around them. They declared this heavenfall to be the start of history. So monumental was it. And everyone fell into line. Well, fell into line more or less. Now that we've established our year zero, you can understand that the mists of time I alluded to earlier were a long, long time before that. And here's where we really have very few written records, naturally. So when I say that the first recorded heavenfall was in the year minus 1450, you'll understand that we're lucky to have anything at all. But it appears as if this heavenfall was such a significant event that people across the continent made note of it in various ways. And various ways it was, because at that time, in the world below the war in the heavens, civilization was just getting started, so to speak. They were getting the hang of living together in numbers for the benefits that brought. But it was still early days, with towns across the continent and vast stretches of uninhabited land between them. The scholars of heavenfalls throughout the world below the war in the heavens have pushed the date of this earliest recorded heavenfall back and back as more evidence has been discovered. This year, minus 1450, was established and generally agreed to in the realm of Queen Sendia and King Laws, the joint rulers in present-day Anarquist, the monarchs whose disappearance has thrown contemporary Anarquist into chaos, by the way. Evidence of this heavenfall came to light in 1790. What was found in a buried chamber in the abandoned and desolate land of Ulm, in the far southwest of the continent, was a small chest containing earthenware tablets, which had been incised with a language that took 10 years to decipher, having only passing resemblance to any language used across the continent in the present day. When the tablets were finally able to be read, it was clear that they were descriptions of a monumental heavenfall and of the object that was recovered. According to the tablets, minus 1450 heavenfall was a large fragment of a bracer, one of those protective arm guards used by archers. Fully as large as two tall men, it was estimated that this was only a third of the original object. It was made of a metal something like what we would call bronze, but much harder and lighter. As with many heavenfalls, it was completely covered on the outside with the extraordinary objects we now call scales. Even though those who were documenting the heavenfall were doing their best to be objective, the wonder is clear. Their awe is apparent as they try to find the words to describe the unearthly. Now, of course, I've only read translations of the original tablets, and I have to say that Persimmon Hoskin has done an outstanding job and presents us with a text that is clean, clear, with just enough appropriate lyricism to deal with the extraordinary. And that mustn't be forgotten. Awe is a state of being that's hard to sustain when you think about it. It's generally a momentary thing. Something hits us and we're awestruck and then we move on. But in the world below the war in the heavens, it's something that can last for a long time because the source of the awe is undeniably real. Persimmon Hoskin's translation of these early texts manages to convey that sense of the ineffable through careful and delicate prose. After this minus 1450 heavenfall, we have many documented instances of other heavenfalls from right across the continent, heavenfalls large and small. At times they come in a rush, with objects falling almost in a deluge. Many scholars have postulated that these are evidence of large-scale battles in the heavens, and for once, no one has seriously discounted this theory. Phidias Cogens in minus 222 did compose a monograph where he claimed that these deluges were actually the result of extensive spring cleaning overhead, with both gods and demons clearing house and disposing of unwanted items in an expeditious manner. This, of course, is a flight of fancy and totally ignores the battered state of many of the items, some being slashed, others being well dented, others bearing the traces of godly or demonic blood. And Codgen's monograph also ignores the existence of actual body parts, digits, extremities, and even whole limbs in some cases. Phidias Cogens had a brief literary ascendancy in Jessen, but was apparently better known as a wine merchant and blackmailer. The great Anarquist heavenfall of the year 70 was another landmark in the history of heavenfalls, and it's a standard by which others are measured. It was the first and only time that an entire body of a god fell from the heavens. It was such a staggeringly rich instance that it helped to establish the fabulously wealthy realm of Anarquist, the monarchy that endures until the present day and still dominates the history of the continent. Since the great Anarquistian heavenfall, objects have continued to fall from the heavens, and this phenomenon has become almost an industry. Fortunes have been made by finding heavenfalls, and wars have been fought over them. Some watch the heavens fervently, hoping to see early signs of a heavenfall. Others prospect far-off reaches of the continent, looking for heavenfalls from ages past, those that were unwitnessed and lie buried beneath the sands. More recently, coastal fringes have been searched on the theory that as many heavenfalls must have struck the sea as the land, but this development has been stymied by lack of means to see or reach anything beyond the shallows. Over the centuries, various systems of categorising heavenfalls have been proposed, but here's the one most often used in the world below the war in the heavens, in the present time anyway. 1. Arms and armour. 2. Body parts. 3. Other, the miscellaneous file. Let's take that first category first. Arms and armour. This is a bit of a catch-all label for the sorts of military technology that fall from the heavens above. To most, it means weapons and the sorts of defensive wear that combatants clad themselves in when going into battle. But it has really come to mean much more than that. And under this heading, you'll find all sorts of material that you might expect to see on a battlefield, but also in the camps and deployed areas adjacent to the fields of combat. This means items of a surprisingly domestic sort, such as eating utensils, mugs, cookware, and so on. The more prestigious and thus more highly prized are the weapons and the armour, but anything that falls from the heavens above is not only valuable, but a potential source of great magical power. 2. Body parts. The temple, the widespread organised religion across the world below the war in the heavens, has tended to give this type of heavenfall more euphemistic names, such as the divine corpus or the deific remains. But when it comes down to it, what we're talking about is bits of godly corpses, and a reminder that the war in the heavens is exactly what it says on the label, physical combat, where great damage is inflicted on heavenly forms, and the demonic equivalent. Hands and arms, often still clad in their armour, are the most common heavenfall of this type. And again, using this evidence, an energetic field of studies has grown up, looking at wounds inflicted, and trying to deduce the sorts of combat that's going on overhead. When you put together this with the fragments of weapons that fall, a reasonable picture has been built up of different types of confrontation, ranging from being upon being to massive ranks, columns of infantry, cavalry charges, different types of siege weaponry and ranged weapons, such as massed armours. So, as below, it is above. The actual body parts themselves are fascinating. The gods are extraordinarily tall, taking the Anarquist heavenfall as the phenotype. This intact body was somewhere between 300 and 400 metres from head to foot, which is in some way reassuring. A massive and astonishingly handsome god satisfies everyone's conception of how a god should be. If this heavenfall had been a gnarled, wrinkly, metre-tall being with snaggle teeth and stringy hair, it would have been a disappointment if nothing else. So with a 300-metre-tall body, all the rest of the body parts are in proportion, the hands being roughly 1/14 of the 350-metre height, so about 25 metres from fingertip to wrist. This helps to explain why most heavenfalls tend to stay where they land and settlements grow around them, which, if the leaders of the settlements are at all canny, well, they grow into towns and then cities. The most striking feature of the body parts is the scales. The gods above are evidently covered in what to them are small, overlapping and scintillant scales of many colours. They're attached to an integument and are a dazzling, hypnotic aspect of the heavenly remains. While anything that falls from the heavens above is imbued with the power of that remarkable place, the fact that scales can be detached from the heavenly remains and essentially repurpose has made them the basis of magic in the world below the war in the heavens. For a fuller explanation of scales and the immense variations therein, look back on episode 5, where I explore the topic of magic. Three, other. Other objects fall from the heavens above, and many of them are perplexing. Some are baffling, and others are cause for grave concern. Just when the majority of scholars are agreed upon an aspect of the heavens, something plummets to the ground that upends all of that. An example is the third documented heaven fall in 1422 in the southwest of the continent, near what is the realm of Resmir in the present day. This was a relatively small object, a broken disc about the size of a wagon wheel, and once it arrived at the local temple, much conjecture ensued. Eventually it was declared to be a ritual object, perhaps an aid for a pre-battle meditation. This spawned considerable literature devoted to theories of pre-battle meditation in the heavens and how individuals or groups would ready themselves through calming practices. Stories and plays were written, including scenes of such, and some temples even began including sessions along the same lines as imagined for soldiers in the various realms on the continent. All of this went up in smoke in 1504 when the scholar Juno Ameff examined the artefact, which by now was on display in the main temple in Resmir, and it had become a centre of considerable pilgrimage. After some time she concluded it was half a button, and she found support for this from others, and in particular some who came to debunk her findings, but ended up supporting her. A side note, Resmir lost the income from pilgrims looking to view this supposed pre-battle meditative artefact. They quickly gained a considerable stream of pilgrims interested in heavenly haberdashery. Demonic artefacts. The alert among you out there will no doubt be narrowing their eyes and saying, look, all that's well and good, but I thought this was meant to be an eternal battle between gods and demons. And yet, all that's been mentioned here has been on the godly side. What about the demons? Don't they lose equipment in battle? It's a good question, and it points to a dark area of history and culture in the world below the war in the heavens. Indeed, artefacts of demonic origin do fall from the skies, and recorded mentions of these are few and far between for two reasons. The first is that the temple sees an object of demonic origin as not only ungodly, but as actively evil. They want to paint it black. Anyone who unearths and keeps such an artefact is immediately considered heretical, and in the past has been subjected to extreme punishment, excommunication at the very least, and burnings, executions of the more grisly kind, being common over the centuries. It's rumoured that a mysterious and somewhat sinister arm of the temple has been vouchsafed the job of rounding up every artefact of demonic origin possible and storing them in secret vaults in far-off parts of the continent. This company is said to be ruthless in the extreme, and over many centuries has gone to extraordinary ends to put its hands on demonic artefacts. The even more alert among you will be thinking about heaven falls and their impact. A very real impact, I mean, of something huge plummeting from the skies. Like dinosaur killers, anyone? And this is another instance where the unearthly nature of the heaven falls is apparent. If something the size of a dead god hurtles to the ground, the impact would be, not to put too fine a point on it, earth-shattering, if not for one thing. Magic. The way that these body parts and objects fall is not the way that normal earthbound objects fall. They fall much more slowly, almost as a leaf falls from a tree, slipping sideways, drifting, almost descending in a leisurely manner in defiance of gravity. This isn't to say that the impact is entirely gentle. No one would want to be near a large heavenfall when it strikes the earth. Ask the hamlet of Tosca in the Lakes region of the Central East. Actually, you can't ask the hamlet of Tosca in the Lakes region of the Central East, as it was obliterated when what was later declared to be half an axe head fell on it. Large heaven falls throw up somewhat of a crater, even though they may settle slowly enough for sharp-eyed observers to get a fix on them and put together expeditions in the hope of staking a claim. Smaller heaven falls may still bury themselves, depending on the ground upon which they fall. This accounts for the difficulty of finding some heaven falls and the luck that prospectors need to have on their side. This leads us to the precarious and somewhat dangerous business of heaven fall prospecting. Once the nature of heaven falls was determined, it didn't take long for individuals of an ambitious and, dare I say it, greedy nature to think of getting rich quick by unearthing one. Good luck, I say, as any heaven falls close to civilization are quickly claimed and fought over. Looking for the overlooked usually means braving the hardships of the inland, that vast wilderness of the continent. As well as extreme conditions and often lack of water, considerable parts of the inland are effectively lawless beyond the borders of monarchies and city-states. And that's not to mention the presence of deadly wildlife just waiting to make a day go from bad to worse. To many, going prospecting for heaven falls was a synonym for marching to one's death. Regardless, the potential riches lead many to launch into the beyond. Stories abound of those who struck it rich, and just as many tell of privation, betrayals, and often cannibalism, which seems to feature often in such tales, enough to make one wonder if some prospectors engaged in it preemptively just to get ahead of the others. Where one field of human endeavour opens up, others latch on in order to make money. With a regular stream of prospectors embarking on expeditions into the inland from about minus 400 onwards, a sub-industry quickly arose equipping such adventurers. Cities on the edge of realms, those on the borders where the prospectors would be leaving civilization behind from, became staging posts ready to provision these brave or foolhardy souls with food, equipment, and beasts of burden. As the endeavour of heavenfall prospecting became established, especially in the more far-flung parts of the continent, these border towns, staging posts, became recruitment sites as well as provisioning centres. And thus recruiting became a business in its own right, with famous or infamous recruitment agencies springing up in lonely, isolated locations. Single prospectors have always existed, and still exist, but their heyday was a millennium ago. With competition and with greater understanding of what success needed, expeditions have tended to grow. In the present day, substantial prospecting companies exist, sending large expeditions with hundreds of people, sometimes having multiple expeditions in the field at the same time. Larger expeditions, therefore, need various skilled workers. Those who could care for horses and other beasts of burden. You need wagon rights, cooks, guides, scouts, and many, many more. Recruitment agencies made most of their money, however, from providing quasi-military guards to protect the expedition. Again, the quality of these range from those who may have once been tavern bouncers to those who had real military training and experience. The reasons for some of these to have left their regiments and to be seeking employment far from civilization were never canvassed, but surely prompted speculation. Another sub-sub-industry flourished as well. Since heaven falls were, to all intents and purposes, the equivalent of buried treasure, shady customers sidled through these staging post towns, all too ready to sell maps that promised to show the location of unclaimed heaven falls of staggering riches. Enough inexperienced types didn't stop to think why someone would be offering to sell a map for a handful of gold pieces instead of using it themselves to make this a booming and long-lasting business. Even in the present day, many dubious types abound in border towns, ready to sell maps to the unwary, or, more likely, amused souvenir hunters, only too aware of the bogus nature of the cartography. In around about minus 300, the nature of magic came to be better understood, especially the manner of harnessing it when the scholars in the city-states began to codify and systematise it, as discussed in Season 1, Episode 5. One upshot of this better understanding was the classifying of magic-capable adepts or practitioners. The most important of these types of adepts are the theoreticians and the fabricators, but a somewhat rare propensity also exists, and that is the percipient. Percipients don't harness or wield magic. Instead, they're sensitive to it. Naturally, this ability is on a scale, with some only being mildly aware of magic when close to it, and others who can sense the presence of magical objects at a great distance, and everything in between. Percipients are often employed in magical workshops or by scale merchants suspicious of fakery. But once their abilities became clear, percipients have always been highly sought after by prospectors. The more honest prospectors would pay handsomely to have a percipient join them on an expedition, but it's not unknown for the more underhand and dangerous prospectors to resort to kidnapping in order to have a percipient as part of their troop. A side note. In the present day, in the world below the war in the heavens, a surprising subgenre of literature exists that has the abduction of a percipient as its theme, lurid, sensational, and usually with scant concern for anything approaching reality about geography, history, or realistic motivations. The poor percipient is usually treated appallingly and suffers beatings and often whippings at the hand of their kidnapper, who they eventually fall in love with. This form of literature has a fervent following. Sustaining a claim. Historically, Heaven Falls have pretty much been a finders-keepers sort of thing, but with the understanding that hard as the former might be, the latter has proven to be just as hard, if not harder. Secrecy helps, but exploiting a Heaven Fall and turning its potential into hard, cold riches usually necessitates the involvement of others. Some lone prospectors have tried unearthing their find by themselves, then detaching the scales, then taking a circuitous route back to civilization to sell the scales, before taking another circuitous route back to the Heaven Fall and repeating. Painstaking and not foolproof. Gradually it became apparent that protecting a claim needed warriors, soldiers, and employing such was usually part and parcel of equipping an expedition. Bona fides were important here, as it wasn't unknown for guards to turn on their employer once a Heaven Fall was found, as in the Greencliff Massacre of 766, a sobering lesson to all, as the guards eventually fell to internal animosity and slaughtered each other before they could exploit the Heaven Fall, the last survivor dying of thirst and exposure. Incidentally, maps of the fabulous Green Cliff Heavenfall are a favourite of shady map sellers everywhere. It's also needless to say that wars have been fought over Heavenfalls, as offensive and defensive wars over claims are almost omnipresent throughout the history of the world below the war in the heavens. A Heavenfall changing hands many times before a claimant has the wherewithal to defend it successfully is a story often told. So that's Heaven Falls, their nature, and more importantly, how they've shaped the world below the war in the heavens. It's not just a religion, even though each Heaven Fall is a concrete and irrefutable proof of a divine realm above the earthly. Heaven Falls have influenced commerce, politics, warfare, diplomacy, culture, the arts, and industry. The war in the heavens rages on, and Heaven Falls continue to fall to the world below the war in the heavens. And that's it for episode 22 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast, a real backwards overview and explainer so everyone can be on the same page. Next episode, we'll explore the reign of Grappina the Cruel of Anarquist. Farewell, and may the heavens smile upon you. This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor, If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell.